So we've been talking for the last bit more than a month now, is it? About Buddhism, well, we've taken the theme as Buddhism through time and space, and that's going to be the theme for the coming year. It's a bit of a cosmic theme, and we must have had four talks so far. I think this one might be the fifth. And tonight's talk is going to be on Sangha. And I just want to start by reminding you very, very briefly of some of the history of the spread of Buddhism. Because as you probably know, the Buddha actually lived about 2,500 years ago. And since his death, Buddhism has spread from northern India, where the Buddha actually lived, southwards to, well, actually at one time it was, you could find Buddhists all over India, well, you still can actually, but not in such great numbers. It spread to Sri Lanka, it spread to Southeast Asia, to Thailand and Burma and Indonesia and Java. It spread northwest from India, so the opposite direction, up to Afghanistan and all those little places that were dotted along the ancient Silk Route that went from west to east. From Afghanistan it went north and then east into China, then to Cambodia, and then to Cambodia, don't mean Cambodia, I mean Korea, and then Japan. And it also spread northeast from India, up to the Himalayan region, to Nepal, to Tibet, and all of those places to the northwest of India. And in all of those countries, there are Buddhist remains. There are temples, there are stupas, there are all sorts of images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, scenes from the life of the Buddha. There are all sorts of symbols, tankas, paintings, shrines, all sorts of things. And in all of those countries, there were great Buddhists who reinvigorated Buddhism, who kind of adapted Buddhism to the conditions of their own cultures, and who left behind writings that we still got. There were people like Xuanzang in China, there was Dogen in Japan, Gampopa and Milarepa in Tibet, just all sorts of great thinkers, and probably most of them enlightened people from all ages of Buddhism, from the time of the Buddha right up to the present century. And now that Buddhism is becoming established internationally, we are linked to those people in a very real way. Although they're very different from us, most of them, many of them, they actually had in common with us something that's really important, which is a spiritual aspiration and a common ethical code, common practices like meditation, and I suppose a common view of the nature of reality, common wisdom. And so they and we are actually part of the Sangha. We're linked with them as being part of the Sangha. The community of people who follow the teachings of the Buddha, who revere the three jewels, who go for refuge to the three jewels, who place the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha at the centre of their lives and their practice. And I just wanted to start off by clarifying something about Sangha, because Sangha, it's a bit like the Dharma, actually. It's a term that can be used in slightly different ways. And I suppose there are three main meanings of the word Sangha. They all mean a Buddhist community of some sort. But the very widest meaning of the term Sangha is just all Buddhists through time and space, or, you know, everyone who is a follower of the Buddha. That's the wider meaning of the widest meaning of the word Sangha. But sometimes you see Sangha spelt with a capital letter. And sometimes that meaning of Sangha is prefixed with the word Arya, which means noble. And the Arya Sangha, or Sangha with a capital letter, is the, it's the community of enlightened beings. So the Buddha, and in a way everyone since the Buddha who has broken through to enlightenment. So realized teachers the arahats, as they're called, many of the enlightened disciples of the Buddha, and bodhisattvas, people who, through the ages, have broken through to enlightenment and who've practiced in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. And actually, the Arya Sangha is slightly wider than that, because it's not just people who have become enlightened. One of the things about the meaning of the term Sangha is that especially if it's the Arya Sangha, the enlightened Sangha, it's the community of people for whom time and space is no longer a limitation. If you break through to enlightenment, you see that actually time and space, they're only constructs of our mind. So if you're enlightened, then you're not confined by time and space in that way. So the Arya Sangha actually includes not only people who have become enlightened, who've broken through to enlightenment, but also the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who represent aspects of enlightenment. Because actually, the distinction between material reality that we can knock and push and the reality of the archetypal realm is also a construct of our minds. Okay? I'll let you mull on that one later. So the Arya Sangha is the Sangha of enlightened beings, including the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then there's Sangha with a slightly narrower sense, in a way, but a more kind of precise definition. And that's the community of Buddhists with whom we practice. Okay? And actually, that one's nice and simple to grasp, because it probably means for most of us, the Triratna Buddhist community, which actually is an international community these days. But in practical terms, for most of us, from day to day and from week to week, it means the people who practice here at the centre, because they're the people that we see most of. And actually, the rest of this talk is going to be mostly about that meaning of the word Sangha. It's going to be about us, okay? About us who are practicing together as Buddhists. So, the Sangha wasn't just something that happened by chance or for convenience. It is actually one of the three jewels at the heart of Buddhism. And from the earliest times, people who wanted to commit themselves to the Dharma, to the teachings of the Buddha, actually committed themselves to not only the Buddha and his teaching, but to the Sangha as well. The Buddha set great store by Sangha. He knew human nature pretty well, and he saw and said as much that building Sangha was a practice in itself that his followers needed to give attention to. So he told his practice on more than his followers on more than one occasion that they needed to practice building Sangha, and that's what a lot of this talk is going to be about. Specifically, the Buddha put an unwavering emphasis on the need for all of us, for all of his followers, for all Sangha members to have friends, and to have friends within the Sangha. When Ananda, the Buddha's closest friend, praises friendship as half of the spiritual life, and most of you know this quotation by heart, the Buddha says, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life." So the Buddha is saying it's really, really, really important. You can't do without it. Don't think you can practice on your own. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And there was another occasion when another of his attendants, one of the people who sort of just helped the Buddha in practical ways, Meghiya complains to the Buddha that he's been off and found this amazing place to meditate and this beautiful mango grove. And it's quiet and it's beautiful. It's ideal conditions for becoming enlightened. And he says, and he comes back and complains to the Buddha that even in ideal conditions, he hasn't been able to do anything with his meditation. And the Buddha says, "When the heart releases immature Meghiya, the first thing that will conduce to its maturity is good friends. The first thing that will conduce to its maturity is good friends, good companions, good associates." And that all the other things that you need to be able to mature as a Buddhist, to mature towards enlightenment, all the other things you need will be got more readily in the company of good friends. So in other words, if we want to develop, the Buddha is being fairly unequivocal about it, we need a Sangha. So the rest of this talk is going to home in on some of the Buddha's advice about the practice of Sangha. How to build Sangha, how to be a Sangha member, how to help ourselves and others in our practice. And in a way, last week, those of you who were here last week will realise that last week we got the pith teaching from Vedanya, the pith teachings of the Dharma. Vedanya said, well, the core of the Dharma is karma. And he talked quite a lot about karma. This week, you're getting the pith teaching on Sangha. Okay? And the pith teaching on Sangha, you will not be surprised to hear, is a list. It's a list with a great name. It's a name that I used to find it impossible to remember. It's the Samgrahavastu with an M. You kind of think it ought to be something with Sangha in it. And it almost is, just to confuse you, but it's not quite. The Samgrahavastus. And the teaching on the Samgrahavastus crops up in lots of places in the Pali Canon, in the earliest Buddhist scriptures. The Buddha gives the list to different people on different occasions. It crops up in the numerical discourses of the Buddha, which means that it's kind of one of those teachings that was known and learned and reflected upon by his early followers. Those are the ones who kind of found their way into the numerical discourses in the Anguttara Nikaya. We find it in the Buddha's advice to the layman, Sivaravada, which I think we might have a talk on in a couple of weeks' time. And he also gave the teaching to his full-time followers. And there's a traditional story associated with it. It's a rather nice story, so I'll tell it. It's a story that involves the Buddha's kind of progress around northern India. The Buddha did a lot of travelling, a lot of teaching. And every now and again, he would do a wide tour. He would go kind of out of his normal little patch of kingdoms to one of the really outlying districts. He didn't do it very often. It took a long time to travel, obviously, because everything was on foot. He went there once quite early on in the time that he was teaching. And then he went back there, we're not quite sure how many years later, but many years later. And when he went back, He was delighted to find a really thriving sangha of Buddhists. And he sought out the only man that he remembered from his earlier visit. And this chap, and I don't know his name, was really pleased to see him. And the Buddha said, wow, this is fantastic. You know, you've got this really huge sangha. And they're all really keen. And they all seem to know the Dharma. And they're meditating well. How have you done it? And this chap said to the Buddha, well, I just followed the advice you gave me. You know, remember that list? Remember the list that you gave me, the Samgrahavastus? Well, I just did that. Here you are with their thriving sangha. So, I'll give you the list in a minute. I build up suspense first. So, okay, we've got a direct link here between the Buddha and the Buddhist followers in the very earliest times. We've also got a link to the Mahayana. Now, the Mahayana is some people say slightly later, but some people say contemporary, tradition of Buddhism that is based on the ideal of the Bodhisattva, I suppose. So in Mahayana Buddhism, in a way, the ideal Buddhist is the Bodhisattva. In Mahayana Buddhism, the ideal Buddhist is the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva is a being who devotes himself to helping all beings to become enlightened. I mean, he devotes himself to helping all beings, full stop, but, you know, the best way to help all beings is to help them get enlightened. So that's what the Bodhisattva, this mythical figure of the Mahayana, devotes himself to. And it's an important kind of myth of the, or symbol, if you like, of the Mahayana tradition, that the ideal Buddhist, the Bodhisattva, devotes himself to building a Buddha land. He builds a land for beings to inhabit where it will be easy to be able to come across the Dharma, to hear the Dharma, to practice the Dharma. And that is called a Buddha land. So, so there's a link here that in Mahayana Buddhism, the way that the Bodhisattva builds the Buddha land is through practicing the Sangrahavastus. And for those of you who care about this sort of thing, the Sangrahavastus are actually listed under the seventh paramitar of the list of the 10 paramitars or practices of the Bodhisattva. The seventh paramitar of the Bodhisattva is upaya, skillful means, upaya paramitar. And the way that the Bodhisattva practices skillful means is to practice the Sangrahavastus. So we've got a list here that links us with the very earliest Buddhists, with Mahayana Buddhists, and therefore to every Buddhist Sangha, really, through time and space. So it's a very important list.
And now I will reveal it.
Oh, anyway. Okay. It's a teaching on emptiness. Okay, the Sangrahavastus. So the Sangrahavastus is a list of four. So at least it's not a long list, even though it's got horrible names. So the first one is Dana, which means generosity. The second one is Priyabhadita, which means kindly speech. The third one is Artacharya, which means beneficial activity. And the fourth one is Samanarthita, which means exemplification. Okay, so that's your list for tonight. I'm going to talk about how we can practice the Sangrahavastus, not only as collectively as a Sangha, but actually individually, because, well, in a way, the Sangha is a collection of individuals. And unless we each individually take responsibility for practicing these, they won't happen. So tonight is about practicing, building Sangha through the Sangrahavastus. Okay, so first of all, generosity. And you'll have come across generosity or dana before. You'll have heard dana before. It's in a way the basic Buddhist virtue, the virtue of giving things, of being generous. But the fact that it's on this list brings out one of the results that generosity brings. If you practice generosity, then the result is that it connects you with other people. So those of you who are mitras, I want you to think back to your mitra ceremonies, which will not require long-term memory from some of the people who are here tonight. But think back to your mitra ceremonies, and just think how you felt when you looked at the cards and the presents that people had given you when you became a mitra. Or if that's so long ago that you can't remember, or you haven't become a mitra, then just think of a time that someone gave you something. Okay? Just think of that. And then just think about how you feel, how you felt. My experience of being given something is that, I feel touched, that someone has just thought to give me something. I feel appreciated. I feel that people have seen me. They've sort of seen who I am. I feel a certain amount of wonder, actually, at that kind of connection with the person who's giving me something. I feel gratitude. I feel warmth. I often feel as if I want to give something in return, even if it's just a hug or thanks or a thank you card or something like that. And certainly, I do feel connected with the person who's given me things. And actually, at my mitra ceremony, what I remember is there were so many presents, and many of them were unlabeled, I didn't know who they were from, that I just felt connected with the whole Sangha. I just felt the whole Sangha had given me a present, or many presents in that case. So Okay, so generosity builds links with others. And it also helps us, all of us, to develop wisdom. And actually, Dana isn't usually seen as a wisdom practice, but it certainly is. There's something about strengthening that positive, generous, connecting, selfless impulses that come with generosity, that just erodes our tendency to put ourselves and our wants and our needs at the centre of our world. So every time we give a gift, however small it is, we are eroding our selfing tendency. We're eroding that separate sense of self that we've been building up probably ever since we can remember. And it might not seem, you know, it might not be a huge breakthrough, but every gift that we give, every time we give something, we're doing a drip, drip, drip at eroding that sense of I'm the important one and then there's the rest of the world out there, eroding that sense of self. And it's eroding that sense of self that's going to lead us to Buddhist wisdom, that's going to lead us to breaking through to enlightenment. So it really is a wisdom practice. And the Buddha recognised this. There's a lovely sutta called the Visakha Sutta, where a woman in the very early Sangha, a follower of the Buddha, who's known for her generosity, comes to the Buddha a bit disheartened about her practice. And the Buddha praises the many skillful states that flow from the practice of generosity. She's a very generous woman. She's always giving gifts. But she doesn't regard herself as very wise, very learned. She doesn't have a lot of time for meditation. She's got a lot of difficulties. But the Buddha says that there are a whole lot of really important higher states that flow from the practice of generosity. And in fact, what he gives is a whole nidana chain. For those of you who know about the nidana chain, sort of one mental state that leads to another, that leads to another, that leads to another, that leads to another, that eventually leads, after about 12 links usually, to enlightenment itself. And they start with, this nidana chain starts with generosity. So if you start with generosity, you are on the path, you are on the way to enlightenment. And, I hope you won't mind me mentioning his name, because I should have asked him first, but Amoghavamsa, I know, takes this sutta as a really important practice, and aspires to practice it as much as he can. And there are other people in the Sangha, I know, who do the same. And it's not surprising that Amoghavamsa is known for his friendliness. I'm just wondering whether can I tell a story about your mother, Amsa? Thank you. Okay. So last week when I came into the Buddha Center, someone who was in the center showed me this really lovely fleece, autumn coloured fleece. Looked really warm, and I admired it. I said, "Oh, that's lovely. It's a really nice fleece." And I'm thinking to myself, "I've never seen that someone before." And in fact, it was a Amoghavamsa's piece. I had seen it on a Amoghavamsa. But the person that I'm talking about had admired it, and a Amoghavamsa given it to her. Just like that. A practice of generosity that just erodes that sense of self. Okay? That drip, drip, drip. And I'm sure that practice will lead a Amoghavamsa to enlightenment before too long. I hope it won't take very long at all, a Amoghavamsa. Okay, so, Sangharakshita says that the spiritual community is characterised by the constant giving and receiving of gifts. Actually, I see a certain amount of that place, so we're already doing it quite a lot. Priyavadita. Priya means kindly or generous, it means kindly or loving or affectionate or kindly, yeah. So, and vadita is speech, so it's kindly speech, this one. And this one, I think, occurs on this list because, well, in a way, speech is our most obvious way of linking ourselves with other people. It's how we communicate, after all. And also, if you think about it, and you probably have thought about it, because we talk about it on the introductory course, Speech is also how we kind of create atmospheres around ourselves. Our speech creates an atmosphere, it creates a world that we then inhabit. And when you get a few people together who are speaking in a particular way, then you can either create, as in some environments, an atmosphere of distrust, an atmosphere of anxiety, an atmosphere of anger or greed, an atmosphere of backbiting, or you can summon up an atmosphere of harmony, an atmosphere of generosity, an atmosphere of kindness and acceptance, just depending upon what you say and how you respond to others when they're speaking. So speech is incredibly, incredibly important. So, you can practice priya vadita, you can practice kindly speech by expressing gratitude and appreciation, by speaking positively about other people. So instead of looking for the negatives in other people, looking for the positives in other people and talking those up in your conversations about them. You can practice it by rejoicing in people's merits. You can practice it by telling people that you like them. That might be an advanced practice for some people, but you can just say, well, I really like you. Or you can tell people why you really like them or what you really like about them. All kindly speech. And in case you think, well, it sounds a bit sugary, it sounds a bit Pollyanna-ish, well, actually, it isn't just that. It isn't just about saying nice things and sweeping unpleasantness under the carpet. Not at all. It certainly doesn't preclude disagreeing with people or telling people unwelcome home truths that they really would benefit from hearing. Okay, with a last bit underlined, that we would benefit from hearing. But it does mean that when you do that, you do it as skillfully and as kindly as you possibly can. And actually, there are examples of that from the life of the Buddha. At one point in the Buddha's teaching career, there's a really vicious dispute going on in the Sangha amongst his followers. And they seem really unwilling to sort it out. And the Buddha asks to see them, and, well, he just tackles the issue head on. And we've got his actual words, part of which are, I won't read the whole story, but he says, "Misguided men, what can you possibly know, what can you possibly see that you take to quarrelling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, that you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, that you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others? Misguided men, that will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." Okay, so he's not avoiding the issue, and he's not he's being very plain about what's going on. He's being very plain that it isn't good what's going on, and he's pointing out the consequences of their speech. This will be to your harm and suffering for a long time. And actually, he's obviously very concerned about the consequences of their unkindly speech, both on themselves, both on the people who are in dispute, and on the wider Sangha. He spends a lot of time in Kosambia, where this dispute is going on. He spends a lot of time trying to sort out the dispute. And if you want to know how it ends, then you're probably going to have to read the Kosambia Sutta. So some of you here, actually, have asked for ordination and are in training to be ordained in the Theravada Buddhist community, and when you do get ordained, then you will take 4 ordination vows. And one of those will be to practice in harmony with your friends and brethren. You will also take on some extra speech precepts. When you become a mitra, you take on a single speech precept, which is about truthful speech. When you become an order member, you take on precepts about speaking kindly, speaking helpfully, speaking harmoniously. So Priya Vadita is very, very much part of an order member's practice. And it's taken very, very seriously when order members are communicating with each other either talking about the Dharma or actually in talking about business. So when business is conducted within the Charatna Buddhist order, so for example at the council members, the council of trustees that run the charity that runs this centre, we have a principle of operating on consensus and of operating under the principle of harmonious speech. And that doesn't mean we can't disagree. It definitely doesn't mean that we never disagree. What it does mean that we're taking on that we're always going to speak our mind as skillfully as we can. We're always going to listen as carefully as we can to what other people are saying. That we're going to be prepared to change our views because of what other people are saying, to try and see their points of view. And basically, whatever happens, even if at the end of a meeting we haven't been able to agree on something, then we're going to part in harmony and probably take the matter up again on a future occasion. And actually, that can be quite a strong practice. It's a way of sorting things out and making decisions, which means that eventually everyone will be behind whatever is decided. Okay, so that's Priyavartita. And the next in the list is Arthacharya, beneficial activity. Arthacharya literally means doing good. But it isn't really about being a do-gooder, in inverted commas. It's very much about what became the Bodhisattva ideal, about acting for the benefit of other beings. So beneficial activity can be very practical, as when the Buddha and Ananda ministered to a monk who was sick with dysentery. I think I told that story sometime last year, actually, when I did a talk on it. Okay, for those of you who weren't here, there was an occasion when the Buddha and Ananda just noticed that one of the monks was very sick. They went into his hut and realised that he was really, really sick. He had dysentery, so he was lying in his own urine and excrement. And the Buddha and Ananda, in a very practical way, got water, they cleaned him up, they helped him onto a bed, and just kind of, in very practical ways, helped to sort him out. So the Buddha would help people in very practical ways, and certainly he regarded the neglect of the sick monk by other monks, because it was a community of monks, as a failing in the Sangha, and he did tell them that. And certainly practical acts of kindness do build Sangha, they do build links with other people. And I see this all the time, because I kind of notice that people in the Sangha are visiting other people who are sick. I notice people going to take someone to a hospital appointment, or help someone move something heavy, help someone move house, do all sorts of practical things that do help other people. But Arthacharya, in fact, refers specifically to what benefits people spiritually. So what helps them grow, really. The Buddha was quite clear to his instructions to his followers that that once they were well established in their practice, once they knew the Dharma, they should pass it on to others. There's a well-worn phrase that occurs in the Buddhist scriptures again and again, where the Buddha says, "Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, the well-being and happiness of gods and men." So the Buddha is quite specific that, he wants people to take the Dharma elsewhere. He wants people to benefit others from the Dharma. So, it's a Bodhisattva practice, sharing the Dharma with others. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be doing what I'm doing and standing up in front of a whole lot of people giving a Dharma talk. That does help spread the Dharma. But so do all the people who help on the team at a newcomer's course, for instance. I think we have 14 people on the team on the first night of the current newcomer's course. And all of you people who've been on teams on newcomer's courses will know that without you, we couldn't run those courses. We get so many people who have so many questions, and the course would need so much organisation that we couldn't possibly lead those courses with just a couple of people. And similarly, everyone who helps in any way around the centre is in a way helping to spread the Dharma. By helping to run this facility for a practicing Sangha, you are helping people to meet the Dharma and to practice the Dharma. Even if what you're doing is cleaning out the loos on a Tuesday morning, that's very, very important in spreading the Dharma. People wouldn't come here if we had dirty loos and no toilet paper. It's true. And actually, the people who are in training for ordination, this is also one of your ordination vows. One of the ordination vows is to practice for the benefit of all beings. And order members take that practice of Arthacharya, that beneficial activity, very seriously. In Sheffield, there are, I think, 28 order members. You can go down and count the people on the wall if you think I'm wrong. I think it's about right. And actually, every single one does something to help around this centre. In a way, this centre is the practice of Arthacharya of order members. It was set up by order members to be a Buddhist centre. And in a way, it's a manifestation of order members' Arthacharya, their beneficial activity. Okay, and finally, Samanarthita, exemplification. So, Samanarthita means exemplifying the Dharma. And at one level, that's very simple, really. As a Sangha, we're exemplifying a different way of being in the world. We're showing that there is an alternative way of relating to each other, and that that's slightly different from the ways of relating to each other that you see in many groups outside of this centre. And probably most of us know that that can seem very attractive, because lots of people, when they come on their newcomers course, are struck not necessarily by what we're saying at the front of the hall, but just by how friendly people are. And actually, that's a real testament to the teams that do help on newcomers' courses. So, as a Sangha, we do it. I think we do it very successfully. We exemplify a different way of being. But when I take this on as a personal practice, to exemplify the Dharma, that can seem a bit of a tall order. Can I, as an individual, really exemplify the Dharma? It may be my highest aspiration, but I wouldn't claim to be practicing the Dharma perfectly all the time. Far, far from it. And you can see this Bodhisattva practice, that the mythical Bodhisattva would exemplify the Dharma the whole time. Their ethical practice would be perfect. But it does actually apply to us too. It does apply to us personally, that we are called upon to exemplify the Dharma. And there's a sense in which, we might not manage to live up to our highest aspirations all of the time. In fact, maybe sometimes it feels as if we can hardly manage to live up to our aspirations for a fraction of the time. But when we do it, we're exemplifying the Dharma. We might exemplify other things at other times, but we do, at times, exemplify the Dharma. And actually, what we can always communicate, however badly we think we're doing, is we can exemplify ourselves. We can exemplify being someone who has an aspiration and who gets it right some of the time, and who some of the time doesn't manage it. And there's something about that communicating ourselves that honestly, that is itself an expression of the Dharma, just communicating how we're doing, our successes and our shortcomings. And I know that I have been most moved by the talks that I've heard in this Buddha Center and elsewhere, where people are actually very honestly talking about their shortcomings, as well as about the things that inspire them, and as well as about Dharma teachings. I remember in particular a talk that Maitri Dasa did when we were talking about the wheel and the gap, and he was talking about his practicing in the gap, in regard to the romantic ideal. It was a talk that I just found very moving, because he was just talking about his own struggles and his own difficulties, as well as, how he managed to sometimes do the right thing. So we can always communicate or exemplify ourselves. And in a way, when we do that, we are a living embodiment of a being who is at a particular point on the spiritual path, but nevertheless on the spiritual path. So we can all, to some extent, embody and exemplify the Dharma. Which brings me to an important an important point that I think is really inspiring. So the Bodhisattva ideal, this ideal of practicing for the benefit of all, is an ideal. It's an aspiration. And we take the Bodhisattva as an ideal in a way, in the same way that we take enlightenment as an ideal, something that we're aspiring to. But we might not really genuinely expect to become a Bodhisattva in our lifetime. Well, maybe you do. I'm not sure that I can make it. Not personally. If we're exemplifying the Bodhisattva ideal, if some of the time we're managing to live it out, then actually our collective practice, the several hundred of us who practice at this centre, does have an effect. Our own personal practice has an effect on the people immediately around us. And actually, those ripples pass on from the people that we're affecting to the ones to the people that they're in contact with. And the practice of several hundred people at this Buddhist centre actually has quite a big effect on Sheffield. And together, you could say that we exemplify the Bodhisattva ideal in a very real way. That to some extent, we as a Sangha are a Bodhisattva. The Sangha as a Bodhisattva is a myth that is common in Mahayana Buddhism, and it's one that's definitely taken seriously by the Triratna Buddhist community, with its strong emphasis on Sangha. Most of you will know that the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, with his thousand arms, is taken as a symbol of the Triratna Buddhist community. And in a way, that is exemplifying what I've just been talking about. It's exemplifying a Sangha as Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva activity just manifesting in the world through all of the people who are part of that Sangha. Okay, so just a little bit before I finish on how we can practice building Sangha and the Sangha Bhavatus. Okay, I suppose the first thing is you don't have to remember the name. Better to remember the list than the name. Both here at Sheffield Buddhist Centre, well, and in the Taraka Buddhist community as a whole, actually we take the Samgraha Vastus very, very seriously. This Buddhist Centre is founded on the principles of the four Samgraha Vastus. So as we go through, I'll say a little bit about that, and a little bit about how you're invited to join in those practices of the Samgraha Vastus. So first of all, we take dana, generosity, as the currency of our economy. The dana economy means no one has to pay anything to get the dharma. We trust people will respond with generosity if they want to. And if they don't want to, then that's fine. And to ensure that you're giving from generosity and not because you feel obliged, we don't bombard you with asks. We don't constantly ask you for money. Once a year, we'll remind you, and actually I mention this because that time is coming, once a year is coming, we're going to remind you that we rely on generosity. If you come to the centre, I'm not sure if it's next week or the week after, then you might get that reminder. But you are very generous. You're very generous with each other. I notice cards and presents a lot of the time. I notice huge mounds of cards and presents at Mitra ceremonies. I notice random acts of generosity and kindness. I think that you're very generous with the whole Sangha in terms of the food that you bring for shared meals, with the Sangha activities that you offer to lead, Sangha walks, Sangha groups, the climbing cooler, the parents group. I think you're very generous in just offering to help, putting away the chairs, collecting the dishes, emptying the dishwasher, all of those sorts of things. Helping with the library, the bookshop, the gardening, the publicity. And I think you're very generous to the wider Tararutna Sangha too, because as we said before, we've raised, as a Sangha, you people have raised £5,000 in the last year. And in a couple of weeks' time at Sangha Day, we'll give that money away, and you'll all vote on where it should go. But if you want to take part more fully in the Dana economy, then, okay, you could give money, you could increase your standing order. You could give your time, your effort, your skills. A lot of people do already. You could do some gardening or join the cleaning volunteers. Or you could just give something to a friend or your mitra group or someone you appreciate. And it could be a gift, but it might actually just be some time. You might just spend some time with someone. Listen to them. Priyavardhita. I said earlier that we take Priyavardhita, we take harmonious speech as being fundamental to the way that we conduct our business in the Tararutna order. But actually, kindly speech is also the principle for communication within the Sangha too. And you take part in that when you rejoice in someone's merits, as a few of you did a couple of weeks ago, when you express gratitude, when you encourage other people. And if you want to practice more kindly speech, you could tell someone that you really like them. You could rejoice in someone when there isn't any formal need to do it. And actually, during the urban retreat, there will be a little postbox where you can put rejoicings or appreciation or gratitude messages into a box, either signed or anonymously, and send it to someone that you want to rejoice in. And I suppose the advanced practice is you could dare to say that difficult thing that needs saying to someone. And just do it kindly and skillfully. If you have got one of those, if you have got something difficult that needs communicating, then you might need to start by doing some metta gardening. Arthacharya, beneficial activity. We've set up the Buddhist Centre, and you take part in it by helping with its many, many activities, and you do, actually. The chairs, I mean, this room was set up by Sangha members who just came up and set out the room. I think it was probably Peter, maybe Tansel. I don't know whether Laura helped. And there's a number of different, I mean, it seems to be, well, whoever's in the centre when it gets done. Peter's done it again and again and again. Must have done it hundreds of times over the years. You could do bookkeeping and admin, like Sally and Susan. You could help with shrines, like Sudhachandaka and Siapadar. You could help with cleaning, like Lou and Toto and a whole lot of others on Tuesdays. You could help with distributing publicity. You could help with painting and decorating on a Sangha works day. You could help with gardening, and so on and so on. If you want to help in a practical way around the centre, just come and talk to me or one of the other team members. You could take part in one of our newcomers courses. Just come on the team and help to run them. I'm going to cut a little bit because we're getting late. Samanarthita, exemplification. So we exemplify our vision in a way through the Dharma economy and through all the other Sangraha Vastus. Practicing exemplification. So you could just simply get on with your practice, but with one difference. You could get on with your practice not just so that I will be happier, but doing it as a practice of building Sangha. So actually doing it for the benefit of other people, doing it for the benefit of your fellow members in Sangha. And actually, that's a very subtle difference, but it does make a lot of difference. If you do that, you'd be practicing for the benefit of the many. So you'd be practicing the Bodhisattva ideal. And if you do it, then you will be helping, in a way, you'll be helping the Sheffield Sangha and the wider Tararutna Sangha to form the Bodhisattva, to make the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara manifest in Sheffield and in the world. So together, individually, we might not be able to be a bodhisattva, but together we can be a bodhisattva as a sangha. On my own, I'm just one person struggling with sometimes not very good meditations, a bit of anxiety, a bit of ill will, a fair amount of greed. But when I'm practicing building sangha, then I do help to manifest a different way of being in the world, and I help to contribute to really generating an atmosphere at this centre and in our wider movement that is tangible and that is inspiring for other people. And that's not just me, it's all the other people, all of you people, practicing in the same way for the benefit of others. So you could say that together we're building a Buddha land in Sheffield, a whole new world, a whole new dimension of Sheffield, the dimension of enlightenment just coming into being in Sheffield. Okay, so that's the practice of the Samatha Bhavastris.